Coney Island of the Mind. I'm going to read about half the poems in here. That'll be about enough, I think. Number one. Constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, and balancing on I-beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing entrechats and sleight of foot tricks and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be. For he's the super realist who must perforce perceive taught truth before the taking of each stance or step in his supposed advance toward that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits with gravity to start her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form, spread eagle in the empty air of existence. Can you hear all right back there? I feel there should be a little space, a little white space between poems. It's kind of hard to get it when you get one pile right on top of the other. Well, number two, sailing through the Straits of Deimos, we saw symbolic birds shrieking over us, while eager eagles hovered and elephants in bathtubs floated past us out to sea, strumming bent mandolins and bailing for old glory with their ears, while patriotic maidens wearing paper poppies and eating bonbons ran along the shores wailing after us. And while we lashed ourselves to masts and stopped our ears with chewing gum, dying donkeys on high hills sang low songs and gay cows flew away chanting Athenian anthems. As their pods turned to tulips, and heliocopters from Helios flew over us, dropping free railway tickets from Los Angeles to heaven, and promising free elections. So that we set up mast and sail on that swart ship once more, and so set forth once more, forth upon the gobbly sea, loaded with liberated vestal virgins and discus throwers reading Walden. But shortly after reaching the strange suburban shores of that great American demi-democracy, looked at each other with a mild surprise, silent upon a peak in Darien. There was a Morris Graves show at the De Young this fall. And the man is a poet. I walked in there and there's this poem just on the wall. Every line in this poem is a title from his poem, from his paintings. Practically every line here is direct steal from one of his titles. Morris Graves. The wounded wilderness of Morris Graves. is not the same wild west the white man found. It is a land that Buddha came upon from a different direction. It is a wild white nest in the true mad north of introspection, where falcons of the inner eye die and die, glimpsing in their dying fall all life's memory of existence, and with grave chalk wing draw upon the leaded sky a thousand threaded images of flight. It is the night that is their native habitat. These spirit birds with bled white wings, these droves of plover, bearded eagles, blind birds singing in glass fields, these moon-mad swans and ecstatic ganders, trapped egrets, charcoal owls, trotting turtle cymbals, pink fish among mountains, shrikes seeking to nest, white foam birds mating in air among hallucinatory moons, and a masked bird fishing in a golden stream, and an ibis feeding on its own breast, and a carved crow with seeds, and a ceremonial bronze taking the form of a fisher, and a stray Connemara puka, life size. And then those blown mute birds bearing fish and paper messages between two streams, which are the twin streams of oblivion, wherein the imagination, turning upon itself with white electric vision, refines itself still mad and unfed among the Hebrides. Wilbur had a Degas poem, I've got a Goya poem. This Coney Island strikes me at the moment more like a museum, but anyway, this is a Goya poem. These poems have numbers, they don't have any titles, so. In Goya's greatest scenes, we seem to see the people of the world exactly at the moment when they first attain the title of suffering humanity. They writhe upon the page in a veritable rage of adversity, heaped up, groaning with babies and bayonets under cement skies in an abstract landscape of blasted trees, bent statues, bats, wings, and beaks, slippery gibbets, cadavers, and carnivorous cocks, and all the final hollering monsters of the imagination of disaster. They are so bloody real, it is as if they really still existed. And they do. Only the landscape is changed. They still are ranged along the roads, plagued by legionnaires, false windmills, and demented roosters. They are the same people, only further from home. On freeways, 50 lanes wide, on a concrete continent, spaced with bland billboards, illustrating imbecile illusions of happiness, the scene shows fewer tumbles, but more maimed citizens in painted cars, and they have strange license plates and engines that devour America. Thank you. surrealist year of sandwich men and sunbathers, dead sunflowers and live telephones, housebroken politicos with party whips performed as usual in the rings of their sawdust circuses, where tumblers and human cannonballs filled the air like crop, when some cool clown pressed an inedible mushroom button and an inaudible Sunday bomb fell down, catching the president at his prayers on the 19th green. Oh, it was a spring of fir leaves and cobalt flowers when Cadillacs fell through the trees like rain, drowning the meadows with madness, while out of every imitation cloud dropped myriad wingless crowds of nutless Nagasaki survivors on newly irradiated bicycles. And lost teacups full of our ashes floated by. This is number 7. Not like Dante discovering a commedia upon the slopes of heaven, I would paint a different kind of paradiso, in which the people would be naked, as they always are, in scenes like that, because it is supposed to be a painting of their souls. But there would be no anxious angels telling them how heaven is the perfect picture of a monarchy. And there would be no fires burning in the hellish holes below, in which I might have stepped. Nor any altars in the sky, except fountains of the imagination. This is a Kafka poem. I've done a lot of name pulling tonight, but name dropping. This is Kafka. You heard of him? Kafka's castle stands above the world like a last bastion of the mystery of existence. Its blind approaches baffle us. Steep paths plunge nowhere from it. Roads radiate into air like the labyrinth wires of a telephone central through which all calls are infinitely untraceable. Up there, it is heavenly weather. Souls dance undressed together. And like loiterers on the fringes of a fair, we ogle the unobtainable, imagined mystery. Yet away around on the far side, like the stage door of a circus tent, is a wide, wide vent in the battlements where even elephants walk through. This is a true story.
What isn't it?
They were putting up the statue of St. Francis in front of the Church of St. Francis in the city of San Francisco, in a little side street just off the avenue where no birds sang, and the sun was coming up on time in its usual fashion and just beginning to shine on the statue of St. Francis where no birds sang, and a lot of old Italians were standing all around in the little side street just off the avenue, watching the wily workers who were hoisting up the statue with a chain and a crane and other implements. And a lot of young reporters in button-down clothes were taking down the words of one young priest who was propping up the statue with all his arguments. And all the while no bird sang any St. Francis Passion, and while the lookers kept looking up at St. Francis with his arms outstretched to the birds which weren't there, a very tall and very purely naked young virgin with very long and very straight straw hair and wearing only a very small bird's nest in a very existential place kept passing through the crowd all the while and up and down the steps in front of St. Francis, her eyes downcast all the while and singing to herself. This poem is it's not a blasphemous intent, despite what my mother-in-law says. it's a kind of an imitation of Lord Buckley, actually. Sometime during eternity, some guys show up, and one of them who shows up real late is a kind of carpenter from some square-type place like Galilee. And he starts wailing and claiming he is hep to who made heaven and earth, and that the cat who really laid it on us is his dad. He adds, it's all writ down on some scroll-type parchments which some henchmen leave lying around the Dead Sea somewhere a long time ago, and which you won't even find for a couple of thousand years or so, or at least for 1,947 of them, to be exact. And even then, nobody really believes them, or me, for that matter. You're hot, they tell him, and they cool him. They stretch him on the tree to cool. And everybody after that is always making models of this tree with him hung up and always crooning his name, calling him to come down and sit in on their combo as if he is Deep King Castelblow. Only he don't come down from his tree. Him just hang there on his tree, looking real petered out and real cool. And also, according to a roundup of late world news from the usual unreliable sources, real dead. I still maintain this could have been written by a liberal man with a frock on. See, it was like this when we waltz into this place, a couple of papish cats is doing an Aztec two-step. And I says, Dad, let's cut. But then this dame comes up behind me, see, and says, you and me could really exist. Wow, I said. Only the next day, she has bad teeth and really hates poetry. Number 14. What could she say to the fantastic Fooly Bear? And what could she say to Brother? And what could she say to the cat with future feet? And what could she say to Mother? After that time that she lay lush among the lolling flowers on that hot river bank where ferns fell away in the broken air of the breath of her lover, and birds went mad and threw themselves from trees to taste, still hot upon the ground, the spilled sperm seed. We seem to be getting into the sexual section here. Frightened by the sound of my own voice and by the sound of birds singing on hot wires, in Sunday sleep I see myself slaying sundry sinners and turkeys, loud dogs with sharp dead dugs, and black knights in iron suits with Brooks labels and Yale locks upon the pants. Yes, and with penis erectus for spear, I slay all old ladies, making them young again with a touch of my sweet swaying sword, retrieving them their maidenhoods and heads. Ah, yes, in flattering falsehoods of sleep, we come, we conquer all, but all the while, real standard time ticks on, and new bottled babies with real teeth devour our fantastic fiction future. Seventeen. In woods where many rivers run, among the unbent hills and fields of our childhood, where ricks and rainbows mixed in memory, although our fields were streets, I see again those myriad mornings rise when every living thing cast its shadow in eternity, and all day long the light like early morning with its sharp shadows shadowing a paradise that I had hardly dreamed of, nor hardly knew to think of this unshaved today with its derisive rooks that rise above dry trees and cough and cry and question every other spring and thing. Another museum poem. I have not lain with beauty all my life, telling over to myself its most rife charms. I have not lain with beauty all my life, and lied with it as well, telling over to myself how beauty never dies, but lies apart among the aborigines of art, and far above the battlefields of love. It is above all that, oh yes, it sits upon the choicest of church seats, up there where art directors choose the things for immortality. And they have lain with beauty all their lives, and they have fed on honeydew and drunk the wines of paradise, so that they know exactly how a thing of beauty is a joy forever and forever, and how it never, never quite can fade into a money-losing nothingness. Oh no, I'll read just two more from this book, and then I have a little Christmas carol. You can do it. Do it after. Okay. Number 19. The penny candy store beyond the L is where I first fell in love with unreality. Jelly beans glowed in the semi-gloom of that September afternoon. A cat upon the counter moved among the licorice sticks and Tootsie Rolls and Old Boy Gum. Outside, the leaves were falling as they died. A wind had blown away the sun. A girl ran in. Her hair was raining. Her breasts were breathless in the little room. Outside, the leaves were falling and they cried, "Too soon, too soon." This is a train poem. It's the last one in this book. The long street, which is the street of the world, passes around the world, filled with all the people of the world, all talking and talking and walking around with their bare faces hanging out, or hanging out windows to see what's doing out in the world, where everything happens sooner or later, if it happens at all. And the long street, which is the longest street in all the world, but which isn't so long as it seems, passes on through all the cities and all the scenes, down every alley, up every boulevard, through every cross drive, through red lights and green lights, cities in sunlight, continents in rain. And the long street rolls on around like an enormous choo-choo train, chugging around the world with its bawling passengers and babies and picnic baskets and cats and dogs, and all of them wondering just who is up in the cab ahead, driving the train, if anybody, the train which runs around the world like a whirl going round. All of them wondering just what is up, if anything. And some of them leaning out and peering ahead and trying to catch a look at the driver in his one-eye cab, trying to see him, to glimpse his face, to catch his eye as they whirl around a bend. But they never do. Although once in a while, it looks as if they're going to. And the street goes rocking on, the train goes bowling on with its windows reaching up, its windows, the windows of all the buildings in all the streets of the world, bowling along through the light of the world, through the night of the world, with lanterns at crossings, lost lights flashing, crowds at carnivals, nightwood circuses, courthouses and parliaments, forgotten fountains, cellar doors and unfound doors, figures in lamplight, pale idols dancing as the world rocks on. But now we come to the lonely part of the street. The part of the street that goes around the lonely part of the world. And this is not the place that you change trains for the Brighton Beach Express. This is not the place that you do anything. This is the part of the world where nothing's doing, where no one's doing anything, where nobody's anywhere, nobody nowhere except yourself, not even a mirror to make you two, not a soul except your own, maybe, and even that not there, maybe, or not yours, maybe. Because you're what's called dead. You've reached your station. Descend. T.S. Eliot just published a poem called Cultivation of Christmas Trees. This is the same title. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no gilded Christmas trees hung with candy canes and breakable stars. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no silver Christmas trees and no pink Christmas trees and no gold Christmas trees and no blue Christmas trees hung with electric candles and encircled by tin electric trains and clever cornball relatives. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no intrepid Bible salesman covered the territory in gold Cadillacs and where no Sears Roebuck creches complete with plastic babe in manger arrived by parcel post, the babe by special delivery, and where no televised wise men praise the Lord, Calvert Whiskey. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no fat handshaking stranger in red flannel drop seat underwear and a fake white beard went around passing himself off as some sort of North Pole saint, crossing the desert to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in a Volkswagen sled drawn by rollicking Adirondack reindeer with German names and bearing sacks of humble gifts from Saks Fifth Avenue for everybody's imagined Christ child. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no Radio City Angels ice skated through a winter wonderland into a jingle bell heaven daily at 8:30 with midnight mass matinees. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awaits again, an unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception, the very craziest of second comings.